the fact is that the case of New Zealand was a monetary issue, that it had, the dollar had to be floated, otherwise it would have destroyed you guys. It's always a monetary issue everywhere, to some shape or form. You know, the reason why people have been voted in any republic or democracy is because they're promising people things that they can only achieve through taxation or through money printing.
Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. In this episode, I talk with Prince Philip of Serbia, a prominent Bitcoiner and chief strategy officer at Jan3. We talk about Prince Philip's work at Jan3, engaging in high-level conversations about Bitcoin with nation-states, as well as his thoughts on monarchy, democracy, and culture. We discuss the role of Bitcoin and sound money and the chance presented for smaller countries such as Serbia and New Zealand to adopt Bitcoin. I extend an invitation to Prince Philip and the Jan3 team to come visit and help spread awareness of what Bitcoin could mean for New Zealand, in particular its connection to energy and infrastructure. If you have any questions or would like to reach out, my emails are always open, hello@thetransformationofvalue.com. And if you would like to support the show, please consider leaving a review or boosting some sats via your favourite podcasting 2.0 platform. Otherwise, on to the show.
Good morning. How are you doing, Cody? Well, good evening.
Good evening. Yeah, no, I'm doing well, thank you. It's been a weird couple of weeks. I'm actually in Japan. I don't know if I mentioned that to you.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, so I'm from New Zealand originally, but I've been over here since like October last year.
Okay.
And I came over, actually, I used to live here, and I came over for Nostra Asia and kind of learning more about Nostra and how all of that sort of interfaces together and just getting to know the community here. And so it's kind of good to sort of get back into it and meet some of the Bitcoiners here and that sort of thing.
Nice. Yeah. In Tokyo or?
I'm south of Tokyo. Okay. I'm kind of moving around. So I'm in an Airbnb at the moment, but south of Tokyo, sort of more towards the beach. I've found as I get older, it's more and more important to be near the ocean, near the mountains.
I agree with you, even though I'm still in the city, but yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah. But you're in Belgrade at the moment?
Belgrade, yes.
Yeah.
Belgrade, yeah.
Yeah, is that the right way to say it? Belgrade?
There's a few, I mean, I guess the anglicized way is Belgrade, but in Serbian it's Beograd.
Beograd, yeah.
Beograd.
It's kind of a strange, real, you know, looking at Europe generally, but, you know, from a New Zealand perspective, from an Asia-Pacific perspective, it really is the other side of the world, and it's sort of kind of engaging with that remotely and from a distance. I find it very interesting. I've always been very interested in history and that sort of thing. But I mean, how is it? I mean, you've been there for a while.
I've lived there now coming up to 3.5 years, over 3.5 years. So, I mean, where do you want me to start?
Because you were born overseas though, right?
Yeah. So okay, maybe I can start a little bit from where I was born. I have a twin. We both of us, of course, we were born in Washington, in Fairfax, Virginia. So that's in East Coast. And we have an older brother. My twin's called Alexander. My older brother's called Peter. He was born in Chicago. And then my parents separated when we're living in Washington about 2 years until my parents separated. Then my brothers and I moved to Spain, Sevilla, with my mother. And we lived there for a few years until a decision was made that we moved to London to be with my father and stepmother. And we were started schooling in Spain, but then continued being schooled in London. And I've spent most of my adult life living in London, apart from a couple of stints. I mean, okay, I went to boarding school for 5 years, and that was outside London in Canterbury, which was stunning. You don't really realize how stunning it was until you leave the place. Then I spent 1 year abroad in Spain, at university, studying Spanish literature, philology. And then I spent 1 year away in Switzerland and 1 year away in a working capacity at a hedge fund, almost a year and a half away in Cyprus. But otherwise, I've been in London most of my life.
Yeah.
Then,
and you mentioned Canterbury in the UK.
Yes.
It's interesting. Again, just coming back to these connections with places, you know, we've got this. Have you been to New Zealand before?
Nope, never been to New Zealand or Australia. The furthest east I've gone, I believe, is Bali.
Yeah, I mean, there's two main islands of New Zealand, and down south there's an area called
There's a
Canterbury.
Canterbury.
Yeah, and it's
Yeah.
sort of this kind of myth building, this nation building project, because it was settled, it was the Canterbury Plains, and it was very much designed from London and designed from the UK. And it was this area that was, has become developed into a very fertile farmland. The city of Christchurch, which is actually a real big Bitcoin hub in New Zealand.
Christchurch over Auckland.
Yeah, so it's an interesting dynamic, and I've sort of found this before. Maybe it's similar with London and other places as well, but the financialized kind of cosmopolitan cities often tend to be a lot more lenient towards shit coins and sort of more financial products, whereas working
Funny that,
class,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Christchurch, I mean, it's a farming city, it's an agricultural hub, it's a manufacturing hub, and it's the home to a lot of stuff. There's a lot of hydropower down south. So there's a lot of stuff happening there. I'm involved with the community in New Zealand quite a lot, and it's kind of a strange. Have you found that with, let's say, like the UK or other places you've lived, where there's that kind of cosmopolitan versus sort of rural divide with Bitcoin?
You know what? So my journey becoming a Bitcoiner, maximalist, I guess, happened when I moved to Serbia. So I haven't really been back to London since, only twice. So one when I finished to sort of pack up my job and leave. That was about it. That was about almost a year and a half ago, or more now, September 2022. And then the other time was just a connecting flight, and I stayed there one night. But my journey becoming a Bitcoin maximus happened as I moved to London on, not from, sorry, moved to Belgrade during June 2020.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I saw that I was into Bitcoin before, but I was also a, into other cryptos, shitcoins, and things like that. I wasn't fully educated yet.
Well,
And yeah, having seen what would happen with them in the markets, because I've been working in traditional finance for 15, almost 15 years at that point, and I thought I knew what was going on. I thought I was switched on, and I understood how well the markets work. But one thing I didn't really understand is monetary theory and how money actually works. And I guess the pandemic, however way you look at it, the stimulus that was brought about in the first in the in the first few months of the whole show was extraordinary, and that got me really thinking. And I saw things that just did not make sense. A lot of things really were warped, and I thought, yeah, this ain't right. And I said, well, there's this Bitcoin thing, and I've got it. I've been stacking it. I mean, I've got some other shit coins and stuff. What if there's more to this thing? And I've always been kind of an advocate, thinking that yeah, it will one day be a part of the future and stuff. But I didn't realize how transformative it is, how great it's going to be. And I really didn't realize its true potential and power until I studied more. I joined Bitcoin Twitter, saw a lot of great, I say, intellectual conversations happening with some of the maximalists there, but as well, a lot of the meme culture was just hilarious, and then a lot of the, I guess you could call it, shit posting was just, just incredible. But that meme culture does deliver a strong message. But then at the same time, I ordered books like the Bitcoin Standard. This was also during the time when Saylor was orange pilled as well, so I was watching Orange Saylor, sort of the his journey into becoming a maximalist, and him going onto interviews and just talking beautifully about Bitcoin, amongst other interviewers as well. But as I said, the Bitcoin Standard, Gigi's 21 Lessons, and Gigi's when he was on Twitter then, I know he's pretty much Noster now. There was a lot of great accounts out there, and next thing I know, I'm just like, there it is. I don't know when it was dash. It was a bit of a gradual moment, not moment, gradual process for me becoming fully orange pill. But there's a few things I could notice along the way that I was like, oh yeah, wow, that makes a lot of sense. I think one of them was a chi it was the difficulty adjustment. And then someone made the relationship with the difficulty adjustment is like, it's if you can relate it to the traditional finance world, the difficulty adjustment is a bit like interest rates. You know, when the market gets heated, they raise the rates. When the market's down, they lower the rates. So to stimulate growth. Well, in the Bitcoin, if the market's heated, then you the difficulty if there's a lot of miners on the scene, then you raise difficulty. And if and then the other way around, if there's if a lot of people start unplugging and stuff, and there's less miners, then you lower the difficulty. And this happens every 2 weeks. And I thought that was beautiful. I thought that was fantastic. And then in when at this point, I was already pretty maximized. But seeing it unravel during the China ban. When the China banned mining in, I believe it was around May 2020, 2021, and seeing the reallocation of hash power around the world and becoming, at one point, becoming much more decentralized, I thought that was okay. This is that's that that is incredible. That's really sealed the deal, really. I know now concentration's up again. You got in the US and in Texas, a lot of the hash power relocated there and stuff, but, I guess it can happen at any point as well. That it's like that beast, a 10-headed beast. You cut off one head, and 100 other heads grow. You say it's impossible to dominate, to control. I thought it was beautiful, like almost like mycelium in a forest as well, where you can completely cut one part off, and it will just keep on growing elsewhere, and it just connects everyone and everything together. Yeah, it was that was so yeah, going back to your question, in Belgrade, there's no big there's crypto here, and there's some Bitcoin maximists who I've become friendly with. But in Belgrade, I would say that there's a more of a tech community happening in the northern Serbian in Novi Sad, and there's lots of work there trying to make that into a I guess as into some sort of tech area. But really, the concentration is and the focus is now is on Belgrade. We recently opened up a hub here in the center of town in Belgrade. It's called Hub 21 in a lo in right downtown. Great location, started by a few great local Bitcoiners. And yeah, I don't see I can't really see like I can't really give you like a difference between the cosmopolitan. I mean, Serbia's not really like that. If I go back to the UK, I think London is such a mess of such a mix and amalgamation of a bit of everything that it'll be hard to say. But maybe I think if you step outside of London, maybe if you go to Brighton or if you go to Bristol, you probably get different cultures over there. Maybe one is more shitcoiny than the other, one's more Bitcoiny than the other. But yeah, I'd like to explore that.
I think there's some connections there. I had a good catch up last year with some of the Suffolk Bitcoiners on this show, and again there was a difference there. I mean, there is pure numbers in the big cities, but I think another correlation I've seen is the ability for farmers and people who work in agriculture to really get it, and they understand concepts. Livestock, the number of animals you've got, hectares, these kinds of concepts really make sense. And that kind of correlates with understanding sound money. I feel the over financialization and kind of the spreadsheets of, the classic image of the cosmopolitan banker really is at odds with that reality of,
That's a
building
great
things,
point you
growing
raise. I
things.
saw a tweet yesterday from someone who I follow quite closely. He's not a Bitcoiner, but he's, let's call it, he's quite red-pilled. Edward Dowd, he's a traditional finance individual. And he said something like, why is it always the people who work with their hands are the ones who are more in tune to what's happening in the world and who can cut through bullshit better than those who work in the city? And that. Yeah, he makes a great point there. That's always the case that you go to where people actually use their hand, farmers, builders, people who trade using the old forms of trade, old forms of building sorry, I forgot, I'm losing my words over here, but I guess
Well, it's practical, right?
of practical, you can, yeah, practical, low, practical, old school economics, basically. And these guys are the ones who can actually see through the bullshit quite easily. So when they see something like Bitcoin, more often than not, they're the first ones to actually realize its potential than those, as you said, I was surrounded by in traditional finance, who who are living in this warped world of markets where they don't really make any sense and then unrational completely. And that has an effect on the human psychology, and people become unrational. And then all of a sudden they're fed this media that's not really as far from rational at all. And then you end up getting all this, well, you know what I'm talking about. You get all this.
No, there is a connection. And I think it's been an interesting journey coming back to Tokyo, which is, you know, talking about fiat cities, you know, the greater Tokyo area has like 20 or 30 million people in this catchment. Pretty much. And so it is absolutely a fiat place. And comparing that with little old Hastings, which is, 40,000 people where I grew up, you know, and it's Apple.
I've been to Hastings a number of times, actually. Yeah.
Or Hastings in New Zealand. So.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. Hastings in South London.
No.
Yeah.
There is a connection.
There is. Okay. It's an art. It's more of an arty town now. Hastings south in South London. It's in south of London.
Yeah, Hastings, New Zealand is rural. It's farming. No, but there's a connection there. And again, it comes back to this. There's this thing that is like, you know, New Zealand is more British than Britain, and it's been said about Zimbabwe and other places as well. But there's this kind of colonial project that happened. This kind of great exodus of working class people and farmers and people who worked on the land to New Zealand in the 19th century. And it's kind of this myth building, nation building project. And I think that was, part of what has come into my understanding of Bitcoin now that I'm in a highly developed, ultra financialized, ultra high tech city or a place like Japan, like Tokyo. And I look back and I'm like, yeah, I understand just these moments and this kind of the lived experience of New Zealand. And I guess I'm interested.
So are you saying, I'm going to be silly over here, you're saying that Australia got all the prisoners, but New Zealand got all the farmers?
Yeah, I mean, arguably, I mean, on my grandmother's side, they did come through via Australia, but they were, that was with the British Army supervising the prisoners. But I love Australia. I lived there for 6 months. You know, I think there's a lot of connection between the two places, but it's certainly a lot more developed. And you know, when you're in New Zealand, when the roads have got potholes and everything's broken, and you know, it's a very it's a very, you know, base layer, if talking in Bitcoin terms. And we're going through a challenge right now. And this is what I messaged you about as well. You know, there's some challenges with government spending. There's challenges with infrastructure.
Oh, of course, yes. Jacinda was quite the character during the COVID era. She really, really looked nasty. I'm sorry, but I don't know what people see in her. The things that she said were very divisive. And I mean, her strong social policies as well, and the overspending that she did. I have not looked at the economics of New Zealand, but I'm sure you guys there are having some tough times with cost of living right now.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. You know, firstly, you know, New Zealand is a small place in terms of population, and it's very connected in the sense that you know, everyone knows everyone, and it's island mentality at the end of the day. And so we talk about Jacinda, you know, I'm one connection away from her. We're talking about overspending. We've just had the Reserve Bank of New Zealand come out with some justifications for the spending during 2020, for the money printing that happened at that point. You know, I've talked to the chief economist of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. You know, they're not in this kind of high echelon, unaccessible class of people.
I get that. Yes. Yeah.
You know, and I imagine the UK, larger countries, you know, there's this kind of, there's different kind of classes, and it comes back to that founding myth of New Zealand, which again, it comes back to kind of fundamentals of removing class. And so it was, you know, if you could get on the boat, if you could get to New Zealand, you could live on the land and you could do what you wanted to do. And so there isn't the received pronunciation. There isn't the Oxfords and the Cambridges, you know, there's none of that class system, at least in the myth and in the national psyche. In reality, there is, I think, in some ways, but that's kind of where it came from. And I guess spending time in the UK, you know what I'm talking about when I talk about class.
Exactly. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Serbia, it's a different, Serbia, there is a class system here, but it's very,
really,
it's very two-tiered. You know, you have the elite and then you have the rest. There is some middle, there is in between, and that's what you'll find in Belgrade. I might not capture the full picture because I'm still getting myself acquainted with the whole place. I'm still learning how to speak the language, but my wife is from here. She's Belgradian. My son is only 5 and a half. He's born here. We made sure he was born here, and before we moved here, my daughter, who was recently born 2 months ago, 5th of November 2023. Very proud of that. But we have my wife has got family here, friends and things and stuff. But we traveled the country quite a lot. But Belgrade is different to the rest of the country. There's Belgrade, which is relatively developed. I say the developed. I hate using that word developed. See, there's more money in Belgrade compared to to outside of Belgrade to the countryside, and you can see a lot more hardship as soon as you go outside of Belgrade. Things get a little bit more real. In Belgrade, you are living in a little bit of a bubble. You see a lot of nicer cars, a lot of more people flaunting their money. Then, as soon as you step out of Belgrade, there's not much of that at all. But the let's say that the societal structure is here. So you do have an elite class, and that's pretty much the product of communism. Or I say communism. They didn't really have communism. They have more of a socialism here during the Tito years. And those socialists that were in power then haven't really gone away. Their generations below them have still maintained that control, but the governance style has just shifted a little bit to becoming, well, I mean, it's a republic now. But they're, the control of the politicians and of the elites and those who have the wealth, it had something similar to what happened in Russia, where when socialism was taken away from here, a few oligarchs were born. Somehow they were the right people in the right place, and they managed to gain the control of electricity, sugar, all those sort of sectors. So you have a lot of you basically have the elite and the rest. And yeah, but then getting to given my position as a prince, I live a pretty average normal life over here. We have a flat downtown in a nice area, I'd say, but I go to the market, I go I'm around, I walk around, take my son to school, drive him to school. I participate in everyday life. But then on the other side, I get invited to occasions where I'm brushing shoulders with some politicians and the Patriarch. Patriarch is the head of the Orthodox Church. Church is very big over here. And I will be, it mingling with those elites and stuff. It's quite a surreal situation for me.
It's a powerful situation though, because you get to see both sides of it. You're still living and grounded somewhat in reality, and you've worked and you've had these experiences. But I think coming back to your relationship with Serbia, I am really curious about that, because you say you're learning Serbian. You've come to this country that you're connected
Yes.
with as well. I mean, how does that feel? What's that search for connection been like for you?
It's taken a while. The circumstances of our birth and later with my parents were divorced, and then moving to Seville, where actually my mother tongue is Spanish. I learned Spanish because my mother spoke to us in Spanish. She's actually the princess of she's a Brazilian princess from one of the Brazilian royal lines. So I'm also a descendant of the only two emperors of Brazil. And she but she lived she was brought up in Spain and living in Spain most of her life, as well as Brazil, but she spoke Spanish to us. Then moving to London, living with my father and stepmother, I would say things were uncomfortable. I was taken away from my mother at a young age, which we should. I mean, those decisions were made, and we have to forgive our parents for trying these things. But it turned out that my brothers and I sort of rejected the fact that we were princes, and we rejected the idea of being Yugoslavs at the time, because it was Yugoslavia or Serbs. That we were forced, we were, taken around, shown places, not shown places. We would go to events with the diaspora and in the United Kingdom, maybe in Germany, maybe in America. And it was just a little bit uncomfortable, like being for us three brothers, like we were paraded around a little bit as the little three the young princes. And as a kid, you don't like that. That's not cool. So you reject. You would re I instantly rejected, not instantly, but it left a bad taste in your mouth. But at the same time, you grow up and you do meet some great Serbs, and during the community, I've met great people and stuff. It's just the circumstances made us have an inbuilt sort of rejectness to our culture, to what we to being Serb. But as I grew older, I always felt the urge to get to know Serbia better and to go move back. And I had the opportunity to in 2001, when my father moved to Serbia with his wife, his second wife, I should say, in as after Milosevic was ousted, Goran Dinjic and Kostunica was where the was a new president, the new government that was forming them, and they opened up the palace to my father and allowed him to live in the palace in Belgrade. Still, it's state-owned to this day, but my father and stepmother lived there. I visited the place a number of times. I still went to Serbia. I became a little bit closer, more attached to it, as we had a sort of home there, but it was still not ours. My father and stepmother are still tenants there. But it didn't feel like the right time for me to move there. I wanted to do it my way somehow, and I didn't know how that was going to come about. And then somehow, well, not somehow, I met my so-to-be wife around 2016, and then we fell in love. And then next thing we know, in 2017, we have our wedding in Belgrade. And beautiful wedding in Belgrade in the Saborna Crkva, which is a Saint Michael's church where my great grandparents King Alexander and King and Queen Mar King Alexander I and Queen Maria were married, and where King Peter I was coronated as well. So quite a historical location, beautiful cathedral church in the center of Belgrade, and then we had the reception back in the palace. And but I still was living in London at the time. I was back in London because of my job. I was working for a quite a world-renowned, I say, financial name, not like JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs, but someone that would be competing with them, but at a more boutique level. And I had a good job back in London. I didn't want to leave that job, but still, okay. Then my son was born. Then we our son was born in the next year. And then that was like, okay, well, he has to be born in Serbia. I believe that's a good idea. So we did that. That was a great thing. That it was the first Karadjordjevic born in Serbia, first male Karadjordjevic in the direct line born in Serbia after like 70 years, 80 years or something, since Prince Tomislav, who was my grandfather, King Peter's the first, second younger brother. So then, still living in London and getting, understanding more about getting more in touch with my culture through my wife, thanks to my wife, who, we go to church, we go back to Belgrade to be with her family, and I'm getting more of an introduction to house, to a more, let's say, a more normal ways of a Serb, even though, yeah, my wife and her family, they're quite recognized. My wife's father is probably the most famous living artist in Serbia, so they're recognized over here, but they live a pretty normal life over here. But I got to understand a little bit more what it is to be a Serb, and I got to appreciate the Serbian cultures, the Serbian customs, traditions, the Slavas that we do. Slavas like family saint days, like in Greece. They celebrate their name days, family name days. In Serbia, it's the family saint day. And that's a big deal here, for example. And we used to celebrate that with our family, but I always found that a very uncomfortable time until I started celebrating it with my wife back home in London. And then it became something special to me. And then this also happened just before COVID. But then when COVID happened, my job moved online. Like most laptop class people, their jobs went online. And then after 2 weeks of this happening, I was like, hey, wait one second. I could be anywhere in the world right now with an internet connection. So I looked at my wife and said, we're moving to Serbia. She's like, okay. Next thing, literally within 2 months, not joking, 2 months, we'd packed up stuff and moved to Serbia.
Yeah, sometimes you get those callings. Are you familiar? You talk about Brazil, and that side of your family. Are you familiar with a concept called saudade? It's like that's the Portuguese word for this longing for a place that you cannot return to, sort of a cultural
No,
concept.
so that no, but I
Saudade.
like this. I like, you know, I like.
So it's a big theme for me, just exploring my own relationship to home and through a lot of my work. You know, my background as an artist and as a creative, it's something that I've always kind of come back to. And in a way, I feel like New Zealand really kind of gets this. You know, there's these concepts of something like whenua or the land, and kind of the relationship to the land and kind of being of the land, and these kind of ideas which are cultural and they're almost unspoken in a way as well. And I think many people are beginning to discover that as we go through this modernity project. And in a sense, communism was a part of that, where you know identity was trumped by class,
Destroyed.
and destroyed.
Families were destroyed, you know, family values and all that, and we lost our ways. We were lost. There was forces against us losing our ways and losing our nationality, in the good sense of nationality, not in the sense that they're trying to portray people who are proud of their countries and the bad sort of, let's call them, right-wing extremists. No, but yes, I'm now experiencing my longing to become to my Serbian roots.
And I mean that's a very natural thing to seek
And I
out,
think, and it feels very natural to me. Okay, yes, I'm having a hard time learning the language. It's not easy at all, but I've really, really got back in touch with the culture here, the ways of here. And going to church is a big part of the Serbian Orthodox Church is a big part of that culture. And you know what? I love it. I feel very much at home here.
I
And
mean it's about.
I'm so happy I did it.
Yeah, no, and it's a great story, and I think that puts you in a really powerful position. And this is where we talk about your work with Jan3 and your ability to interface at both these levels. And in a way, I know what you mean, because I've sort of seen, again, as I mentioned before, New Zealand has a relatively flat system where you know you can walk down the street and see a minister having a coffee in Wellington, for example, the capital city, and it's not really that much of a strange occurrence. You know, there's not all of these like security guards and stuff, and even with the situation we had over COVID, it was still relatively accessible. You know, I think outside looking in, it was certainly problematic, and inside looking out, it was challenging. But I still feel there is this accessibility, and that's sort of in a way what you're able to do as the chief strategy officer at Jan3. So I'm curious, maybe we can talk a little bit about that, like how that's given you the opportunity to talk about Bitcoin at a high level with different people in different countries.
Well, firstly, I mean, it was, you know, maybe an introduction to Jan3 to your viewers, that Jan3 is a company started. It's still in a, I guess. I mean, it's still a startup. It's relatively new. It's formed by Samson Mao, who is probably known as the architect of the Bitcoin bonds for El Salvador. He was a big executive at Blockstream and BTC China back in the days. And you know, he's a very impressive individual, quite a CV, and quite the mind, quite the visionary. And he approached me. So back in Belgium, so like how the story that how we met was that my wife and I were invited to go on the TV show here in Bel in Bel in Serbia, like the biggest TV show for like the Saturday Night Live equivalent. And we got to know the presenter, Ivan Ivanovic. That's the show, is the evening show with Ivan Ivanovic. And we got to know him a few days before. He actually lives on our road. We have a flat on the same road as him, so that was great. We had a drink with him, and he got to understand that I'm into Bitcoin, and we got to interview each other, just to, you know, have something to, so he has some background on us. And then during the show, I'm talking about my work, my traditional finance work, and then he interrupts me and says, "Is this a good time to talk about crypto?" And I was like, "Well," and I don't know if you've seen that clip. I say, "Well, it's not about
Yeah, I
crypto.
saw it. Yeah.
It's all about Bitcoin." And I went, "Blah blah blah blah." Then that was picked up by the Bitcoin community. That went viral. Next thing I know, I'm on my first ever podcast with Daniel Prince, Once Bitten Podcast. Then I'm speaking to the likes of Saif Dina Moose, and I'm on his podcast, and I'm like, whoa, I'm on Saif Dina's podcast right now. It's a really surreal moment. And next thing I know, Daniel Prince was like, let's say we can go to Miami. It's like, I can get tickets, VIP ticket, whale tickets to Miami. Let's go. It's like, yeah, let's go. So I go to Miami and I meet a lot of my like sort of heroes and stuff. It was really surreal. Actually, so yeah, this is quite a strange story. Is that the third? So Daniel was the first in-person maximalist that I met. Andre Loja, who was also, we were staying in the same Airbnb, who's the guy who was orange pilling the president of Madeira at the time, was the second maximalist I met. The third was because we had breakfast at his villa in Miami, was Michael Saylor. And Michael Saylor was I guess the third maximalist that I know of that I met. And then we had an incredible breakfast at his where he was orange pilling the president of Madeira. Very surreal. I had no idea what I was doing there.
Yeah.
But anyway, then later on that day, I actually met with Samson Mao. Samson Mao's like, yeah, I want to hire you. And I didn't really give him much thought, but I was like, yeah, I'm in.
Yeah.
And I
Yeah.
guess he chose me because he knows, I'm a prince. Princes, I guess I'm not an official prince yet. I mean, we don't I say yet. There's a chance maybe one year. It might not happen on my generation, but I'm definitely working towards it for at least my sons, the next generations. But yeah, my position is that given that my title and my experience, and also that I have some financial background, and also the fact that I'm of course a Bitcoin maximalist. I guess it was an easy decision for Samson to reach out to me, and I'm able to maybe unlock open doors that other people aren't able to open. So that's what we've been trying to do. It isn't been as easy as one thinks, but we've had some pretty cool meetings in the last over the last year since I've joined. We met with I mean, I met recently, like last year. I was with the head of the Liechtenstein royal family, Prince His Serene Highness Prince Hans Adam II. We also met with the Costa Rican. This was a secret meeting, wasn't publicized, but I can talk about it. It was with the Costa Rican vice president. Samson was met with the president of Colombia, with the president of Suriname. We met with a lot of potential presidential candidates from around Central America. Samson met with RFK Jr. and DeSantis and people like that. I mean, he was. And then I've also met with a lot of the local president. We met with the Prime Minister of Montenegro. I also have quite close contacts with the president of the Serbian Autonomous Region of Bosnia and Herzegovina. So there's a lot of, yeah, there's. Because of my title, we're able to also not thanks to my title, Samson and the team are able to unlock doors and get into meetings thanks to the local communities in those different countries around the world. That's how we operate is thanks to the Bitcoin communities around the world. But occasionally, I will use my diplomatic sort of channels and ways to try and and get us another introduction here and there. So yeah, it's proven useful, but it's still a work in progress. Yeah, it's an exciting job. I think there should be some exciting news later on this year, I'm hoping. I mean, it's got, we have to put the disclaimer out that El Salvador is really an outlier, a Bukele coming about with that sort of power and that sort of intelligence and situation. It's going to be hard to come by, but I think Bitcoin adoption is going to come in a lot of different forms. I say different forms, not just as being recognized as legal tender, but I think as countries and states will realize that its potential for mining and its use to stabilize energy grids and to just get money, extract money from the resources it has, is going to be big in the future.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm really interested in what your approach is to broaching these conversations. And I look again from my perspective of New Zealand and, being able to walk past the Reserve Bank, being able to see a minister in a coffee shop, it's very accessible. And yet still there's this difficulty in kind of communicating the concept of Bitcoin. And I've been lucky to talk to a couple of think tanks and have people on the show from some of these political think tanks who help provide that information. And I have friends within government as well, but it still seems like there's this cognitive dissonance or this inability to kind of grok it. How do you select a country or select a place that you want to talk to? Like, what's the process for that? And then how do you actually have those conversations with these people?
Usually two ways. As I said before, it's usually we have a lot of people, given that we're known as the nation state adoption company, that's our niche. That's a lot of, yeah, they, a lot of people, a lot of Bitcoiners will reach out to us, and then we will form like maybe a Telegram group. And then we will use any way, either if the local person or group of people have any introductions or ways to get to the prime minister, president, politician, then we will use that route. That's one way. The other way is I will create letters and stuff and try and get introductions in other places using my diplomatic status, which I say is not, I say the local approach is proving to be far more effective at the moment, because that local approach means that those local Bitcoiners have already done a bit of groundwork and have sort of identified the local politician or leader or so who can be orange-pilled or has some sort of understanding. Because if you go directly to someone and say, like myself, if I go directly to someone and say, I want to talk to you about Bitcoin, they'll be like, yeah, just no.
Yeah.
No, they'll just instantly dismiss it. That's usually what happens. But it doesn't stop me from doing it. And on the local level here, I say local, on the regional level here, I've tried to introduce it to some local leaders around here, and the reception is usually quite frosty. But I have had conversation with advisors and been able to dig down deep into what it means for them and stuff, and there is definitely more of some people who understand it more than others. We're still very early in trying what we do, but I think we're still trying to form the perfect strategy. But as you understand, for everybody, it's very difficult orange pilling somebody. It's every person's different, and everyone gets the understanding of Bitcoin at, you know, as the old saying is, you only get Bitcoin at the price you deserve.
Yeah. Well, again, that's sort of, I think, what's very interesting here. Before Japan, I was based in Wellington, the capital of New Zealand, and you know, there is a number of these think tanks and kind of these groups, but again, they're very accessible. That, you know, they're literally across the road. It's a tiny little town, you know, sort of on the harbour. It's a very walkable city, actually, and beautiful in summer, at this time of year, actually, but as well. But the idea of, you know, going to the government is one thing, but actually just talking to these think tanks, and as I said, I've had the chance to talk to them on the show, kind of socially, and you start talking about the energy piece, which you mentioned. And that's, you know, the lights go on for them, because
that's it. Yes.
You know, they understand, look, New Zealand's got some infrastructure challenges. And at the same time, we've got a lot of hydropower in the South Island. There's a lot of natural resources and the ability to develop there. And
so that's one thing we found out is actually energy is one of the best ways to orange pill governments, because people in those positions, really.
Yeah.
As you understand, energy is the most important industry we have, and that runs all industries. And as we know, that recently now, quite a lot of places that are going through, they're having energy crisis, like energy bills just through the roof.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin can really solve that.
Yeah, I mean, and there's, again, coming back to what we were talking about at the beginning in terms of, you know, that connection to the land, you know, again, you know, what does New Zealand mean for me? There is national myth building in there, but it's like, you know, I'm thinking of sheep, and I'm thinking of, you know, of hydro schemes, and, you know, fishing on the tail race, you know, outlets where there's big brown trout there, you know. And it's funny, I was in Shanghai talking to someone, and this is where I had my artist hat on, and I was, you know, trying to be cosmopolitan. And I said, you know, I'm from New Zealand. And she was like, well, what have you got there? You've got sheep, you know? And at the time I remember feeling quite offended by that comment, but literally in the town square of Hastings, where I was born, there's these kind of like ceramic sheep, you know, kind of kids to play on, you know, and that was what the nation was built on. And I think there's something really humble about that. It's also very down to earth. You know, there's not this kind of highfalutin image of the country, and it's very much, and when you come to New Zealand one day, hopefully you'll see, but it's kind of like, well, you know, heads down, let's get to work, very practical. But it's kind of been derailed in the last few years by this kind of political class and the sophistry, and that's what you would have seen with the Jacinda years. And as an individual, you know, I think she was put in a position where that came out. You know, I think these these people aren't necessarily inherently good or evil or any of that stuff that gets labeled. I feel like it's like in the system, that's what kind of emerges, you know what I mean? And so the opportunity to actually take a step back and look at that and think, okay, well, what could we do? What could we, how do we speak to the opportunities here for a small, nimble country to really adopt this? Because certainly it's not going to happen in Japan anytime soon. You know, these 100-year-old ministers.
Yeah, it's the smaller countries that probably move quicker. Your bigger democracies have a lot more hoops and bounds to jump over, so to jump through. So yeah, I don't see places like Brazil and India going onto a Bitcoin standard anytime soon. Or who knows? But I see smaller countries like your Surinames or maybe your Guatemalas and Panamas and stuff and places like that, which just have much more manageable, and they're much more nimble in terms of making decisions.
How do you see, in terms of vision and leadership, because I think this is kind of the question that I come back to a lot, looking at the kind of caretaker governments that we've had in the past and sort of how change happens in these democratic systems. You know, it is very challenging, and you see a lot of just kind of covering your ass and just what do I need to do to get in the next election sort of thing. But what have you seen in terms of leadership, what it takes kind of moving into this new era of Bitcoin for the kind of people that, you know, and the kind of systems that are needed for Bitcoin to emerge and for visions That's for people
good,
to emerge?
Good question. You saw now in America that now obviously things are wrapping up with the Republican primaries, that it looks like it's pretty dead set that Trump will be the nominee there. But you saw that it was about three or four candidates there that were talking about Bitcoin in a positive way. I mean, and one of them outside of that, who's obviously moved outside of the Democrats, there's independents, RFK Jr. But you had DeSantis and you had Vivek and someone else talking openly about positively about that about Bitcoin. That's huge. That's a huge step. I think give it a couple of election cycles. You know, 4 or 5 years of is your call an election cycle. So give it 10 years, and I think in the next couple of election cycles, you'll have more and more people putting Bitcoin on that platform, as they see success in other countries. And I think yes, this bull market is going to aid us a lot when people start to look at El Salvador and seeing their success. You're already having the ripple effects of El Salvador within their region. And all over the world, I would say as well, people are talking about El Salvador, but within their region, places like Costa Rica, like Guatemala, places like that, there are people, there are candidates thinking, yeah, we kind of want to have something similar to what they have happening in our country.
Yeah. Sorry, I was going to say, do you see though, I mean, we're still talking within this kind of political concept of election cycles of a kind of a political world, and you may be familiar with the theses of the sovereign individual, these kind of fourth turning ideas. How do you see that relationship between the kind of the old and the new playing out over the next 5 to 10 years in that case? Oof.
I mean, I've been known to say that republicanism and the democracy that's practiced today is outdated and inefficient. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Like, you know, even the first proponents, I'd say, the first advocates for democracy in the what's his name? Those that you know that type of. I mean, because in this, I mean, Socrates. I mean, I'm not the historian. I'm not the political historian. They had democracy, but it was a very city state at a very elite level democracy. Well, the modern democracy, well, by the advocates, I forget the name of that one guy, but anyway, they never envisioned that democracy would be practiced in such a great population. They see that democracy can only really work in populations way less than a million. So I see that if we're in order for democracy to survive, firstly, it has to move towards a more direct democracy, where. And but that more for that to happen, I see more decentralization happening, and I see models. I see Switzerland coming up as a model that hopefully could be replicated around the world, the canton system, having a direct democracies there where people are able to raise issues with their local leaders and get things done much quicker, and they're far more representative than a small little a voter in a country of 5, 6, 10, 20, 100, 300 million people. It just makes more sense.
Are you familiar with the MMP system?
What does that stand for?
Mixed Member of Parliament.
No.
Is that something you've come across? So this is the system of New Zealand, and I also believe Germany has this system where you get two votes, so a party vote and then an electoral vote for your area.
Okay, yes.
And it was sort of developed, the traditional one people are aware of is, you know, first past the post, you know, who gets the 50%. And so what it means effectively is that you generally have to govern with small parties to support you, and it leads to a decentralization of the system. And so what you're talking about is absolutely right with the United States or, you know, larger countries. You know, what are you going to go left or are you going to go right? And it leads to that dichotomy. But, you know, there is potentially innovations like MMP, which in the current situation in New Zealand, we have, a major... you know, block of a majority block that's comprised of three parties, which potentially opens the door for one of those small parties to actually be Bitcoin aligned. And it doesn't have to be the big, you know, the big mega party. It can be, and they only need 5% to be in, you know, in parliament. And so I don't know. So you haven't come across that with
yours? No, I have. Maybe I just didn't know it was called the MMP system.
It may be called something differently in German. And it's slightly different to the Canton system, but that's also a really good model to look at, I think.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm all for changing a lot of other systems out there. I mean, I've been given quite a bit of criticism for saying that I'm not really that for democracy in its current state and form. And I guess I'm an anarcho-capitalist, and I believe that's where real freedom is. But then I would also argue that also I would for the transition to get there, then you would have to have some sort of move through a direct democracy and not what we have today. And so I said MMP with maybe or Canton system. People will like to hold on to their identity and their nations and stuff. So that's why I think you need to have that nation. You need to have that that collective or community. So then that's why also I'm an advocate for monarchy, not just in its purest absolute form, but also in as a constitutional form, but with more power given to the monarch to add as a check to the current political executive.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of ideas that are floating through my head, really. But my main concern is that I think that we don't want to lose our identities and who we are and where we've come from. And I think if we go to some pure anarcho-capitalist world where everyone there are sovereign individuals, I think that will lead to, and we could end up having a situation where people just completely lose their identity. So that's why I'm a great believer in the church and monarchy. And the idea that they can be sort of hold as bastions of traditions, culture, family values, continuation, and just they but this only can only really work, especially as in an absolute monarchy, that the control is always is handed to the people, and it can only work under a Bitcoin standard. There cannot be such thing as a central bank. Otherwise, the whole project will fail again.
Yeah. Well, that's, again, something I reached out to you about. I found very interesting is that approach to monarchy. And I guess, again, comparing and contrasting this with the lived experience in New Zealand, where, still part of the Commonwealth. We've got King Charles is the head of state.
Yes.
We've got a governor general who also lives in Wellington. There is these traditions. And if you go back a few years, you know, still had the Privy Council, in London or wherever that was making these decisions about things. And those systems have slowly changed over time. And I guess the bigger idea is that the forming myth of New Zealand was kind of leaving that. And so, New Zealand was formed as this kind of egalitarian, nation building project. And then really the big turning point was the First World War, Gallipoli in particular. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that campaign, which,
No.
you know, saw the New Zealand and Australian, you know, the colonial soldiers go to fight in Gallipoli, and it was a massive failure, and thousands of soldiers died, you know, Kiwi farmers and, you know, local boys effectively. And that really began the journey away from empire. And where we're standing today, I think there is certainly a hot topic. I mean, I don't think anyone's pining for empire in New Zealand, and certainly a hot topic around what that means and the kind of historical challenges there, especially with the Maori people, and just sort of that connection. And there's a lot bundled up in there. And sorry, I know this is maybe a new area for you, but sort of how do you see monarchy working in a system like that where there's a lot of historical baggage associated with something like the king?
I think probably that New Zealand would have its own monarchy. I'm sure there's every country can have its own royal family.
How do you bootstrap that? I mean, I've got
I don't know, that's the
I've got
thing.
a little sort of story here. So researching about that, you know, there was this moment. So again, New Zealand's sort of the founding myth, and again, these are narratives. They're not sort of absolutes with history, but there was the movement in New Zealand around the Maori king and Kingi Tanga, and that was really seen as an alternative to Queen Victoria in the 19th century, and sort of the founding of the nation. And sort of that alignment with empire was really challenged by this project. And interestingly enough, and I've done an episode on this, there was a banks and a central or a central bank developed under that kind of umbrella of the Maori king, but it failed because it had to do full fractional reserves, whereas the colonial banks were able to just print the money. And so there was
Yeah,
this
there you
kind
go.
of There's this game theory playing out that it eventually collapsed and it didn't really succeed. And so that's the closest we've had to like a homegrown, you know, homegrown royalty. But I mean, how do you bootstrap something like that? How do you elevate someone, you know, to that higher level? Is it something you vote on? Is it
That's, I
referendums?
don't know. That's a very good question. It's something that could be explored. I mean, one country, I say country, one state in America that's very interesting is Hawaii. Hawaiian, they have their own royal family, but they obviously, it's not, they have, they're unofficial, but they would do any, I would say they would do anything. They are living there well. They have, they are, they would, if Hawaii became independent, they would have a monarchy. I think that could, I mean, I think there'll be other examples around the world that could happen. If I think it's just gaining their independence away from that Commonwealth, in the case of New Zealand, Australia, I'll probably get some backlash for saying this, but yeah, I think the Commonwealth is, you know, I shouldn't be talking. I'm not talking bad against the British royal family, but I think their reach is too large,
Yeah.
and I don't, I don't, I. I'm very pro monarchy, but I'm also very pro decentralization and for smaller places. And I think their reach is too far to serve as a proper monarch, because they can't be a unifying figure for so many people. I think that's not
Yeah. Well, and I mean,
feasible.
and really recently, obviously, with Queen Elizabeth's passing, I mean, that was, you know, we grew up with that. And she was this you know long-term thing, and I certainly think the challenge that New Zealand will face with Charles is that there just isn't that affinity. And you know,
No,
are we
well,
going to redo
that's,
all of
yeah.
the money? We're going to do redo all of the stuff for you know God Save the King, when really no one cares anymore. But the challenge is, Prince Philip, that we've got this situation where a lot of these founding documents, a lot of the sort of the structure of the country, and again, so this is hard to kind of convey in this sort of short format, but the idea of the crown is a concept that I think perhaps in all of the world and all of the Commonwealth is most pronounced in New Zealand, in the sense that founding documents, the Treaty of Waitangi, for example, in New Zealand, which really was that relationship between you know the crown, the, you know the colonizing force and the Maori people of New Zealand, it's all signed by the crown. What does that mean when there's no longer a crown? Does the local government, the vernacular government, take responsibility for that? It's sort of a very problematic politically, and you know how do you roll that out? And I don't think 3-4 year election terms, that's just not a topic that they're going to touch. And we're seeing that play out, and it was a little bit more pronounced. There's just been an election in New Zealand, and so there has been some rollback of some of these more radical policies. But certainly, I feel like a lot of that, I mean, money, forgetting about that for a moment, fixing the money seems like a more pressing, more accessible thing because I tell
Well,
you,
of course.
I'm shocked with the inflation and the price of things in New Zealand still.
I think that's so for that for monarchies to start appearing, more monarchies to start appearing again. I think the only reason I'm saying that is because I think you need to have money that is able to be transferred generation to generation far easier. So dynasties will be reborn and dynasties will be created. And I think that's going to take generations for us to have more monarchies out there. So how they play out, every situation, every country, every region is going to be different. And maybe monarchies don't play out, but the most important thing is that free money plays out, and that allows people to form lasting connection to the land and not having to move away to chase that money printer wherever it is, and to destroy families and to destroy traditions and destroying ways of life all over the world. We need a restoration of a lot of the great cultures out there who are being sadly infected by this liberal disease, are now having birth rates of below 2.1, so they're not being replaced. So we have dying cultures out there. You know, none of the liberal cultures out there, none of the liberal countries out there have, and this is a Serbia included. Serbia's not, I don't know what, how to classify Serbia, but Serbia, it's very sad. I've seen now that the birth rate of Serbia is 1.412, I believe. That's not going to cut it for replacing population. And on top of that, people are leaving the country. There's brain drain. This is the problem that we have because of the money.
Yeah.
I
Well,
think when we fix, when we fix that and we reverse some of the damage that communism has done through its branches like feminism, and please, I don't want to sound like a chauvinist over here, but I think that's done a huge amount of damage and create in family values. We have to bring back the idea, notion that that families is what makes us human, and that being a housewife is not a derogatory or a bad job. Being a housewife is probably the most important job out there. I know it doesn't get paid, but it's the mother of children is the most important bond in humanity. Yes, fathers have an important bond as well, but that mother to son and daughter, mother to children, is what creates generations, is what creates humanity and continuity. Without that, we're lost. So I don't know what the hell these people on about when they're trying to put to trying to pit women against men in the workforce. And again, I'm going to get a lot of slack for this, but just look at our birth rates.
Well,
What are we doing? We want to die off.
these are, I mean, look, these are important conversations, and I think asking the question is really important. And I wonder, just coming back to your point about monarchy, though, I wonder perhaps, I mean, again, there's connotations, and it's sort of, get the talk, we call it tall poppy syndrome in New Zealand, but you start talking about King Charles, and it very, very much is like, well, let's not go there. But if we replace that word with custodian, and we use some Bitcoin language here, but custodian, what does that mean? Because the political class that we have in New Zealand, and this is coming back to a sovereign individual kind of concept, that they're just, dancing monkeys, and they're doing the
That
thing
is, yeah.
to appease the people. What
Exactly.
does a real custodian look like? Because I think that's where you can have a vision for a nation, and we had that once upon a time.
A real custodian is someone who can get is you can unite people. Doesn't matter race, class, religion, and all that. And but the thing is, it can only really happen if he has no access to a money printer. So therefore, the central bank has to disappear. And then we're working under an Austrian economic style model, and getting rid of all Keynesianism whatsoever. I mean, this is what my idea of what a monarchy is. It's a custodian of traditions, of culture, of family values, and I think the short-termism of republicans of democracies these days are it's incredibly damaging. It has so many bad side effects.
Yeah. Well, that relationship with the state and this kind of paternalism has been problematic, and we see that in New Zealand, where the government, the nanny state, has a historical relationship. And again, I mean, it's hard, maybe hard to talk to from your perspective for the New Zealand situation, but that was a project that did get broken down. You know, we saw there was a sort of post-war consensus, it was called. It was very socialist. I mean, my grandmother tells me about, you know, the old days. You know, there was one place where you could buy a television in the 60s and 70s, and it was a ministry from the government that was doing it. You know, you had the post office doing telephones and everything. And that really got unbundled quite rapidly in the 1980s with a period of neoliberal reform. And in a way, New Zealand changed drastically, but I still feel like a lot of the deep cultural elements got transmitted through time. They kind of passed through the filter. How do you activate or roll out similar changes like that that are kind of seemingly, it's like pulling the band-aid off, but actually they help solidify what's, you know, what's good and let the bad stuff sort of fall away?
How do you fix degeneracy and debauchery in this world? I just have to go back to its central banking has made had and money printing has seen has given the us the ability to not think about tomorrow and just spend today because of inflation. You know the deal. So I think as soon as you fix that, as soon as you have people, give people the opportunity to save in to have money that that can't be debased away, then they start to think more inwards towards their families, towards longer term goals, and over time that will start to fix the social fabrics that have been destroyed thanks to debasement and neoliberal policies that are the result of expanding money supplies. So, yeah, it all goes back. It all go back to fixing the money.
I do say, I mean, I must push back on that. I do feel there is a bigger, and again, this maybe isn't the format for it, but there is a bigger topic there. I mean, looking at the historical moment that those neoliberal reforms were birthed from, I mean, similar things happened in the UK, as you may know, the privatization of coal mining or whatever. You know, there was a lot of pain that happened, and then that led to the current state. And would that have been viable to not do that? Because that we were about 3 days away from being bankrupt until we floated the dollar back in the 1980s. And there
Right,
was
yes.
there's you may be familiar with that. You know,
I'm
it used
familiar with that. Yeah.
and so there is a historical moment there. So I think it's hard to be specific for or you know to apply a single idea to every place in the world, right?
That's the thing. That's exactly the point. But the fact is that the case of New Zealand was a monetary issue. That it had the dollar had to be floated, otherwise it would have destroyed you guys. It's always a monetary issue everywhere, to some shape or form.
And
I
it
think
always
not monetary, but not always, but I don't know. I think every politics out there has, the reason why people have been voted in any republic or democracy is because they're promising people things that they can only achieve through taxation or through money printing.
Yeah, well, they're pork barreling it and they're promising it. And something, I mean, you mentioned at the beginning sort of your Bitcoin journey and being amazed with the idea of the difficulty adjustment and how that just sort of automatically happened. I've been reading On Knowledge in Society, you know, the classic Hayek essay, and there's a little piece here talking about civilization and how it advances. And it says, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them, which is sort of
Automation, yeah.
an idea. You know, you don't need to plan it, you don't need to intellectualize it. And I think perhaps in a way, this is also part of the issue is that we're talking about money. We're talking about, you know, having to think about yield, having to think about your strategy for what you do to climb out of it. And it's sort of crabs in a bucket. Whereas, you know, Bitcoin takes you back to some core values of thrift and of just putting your head down, putting in a good day's work, working the land. You know, you don't have to start thinking about what you're doing with your share portfolio and
Well,
busting out.
exactly. That's a very, very eloquent way of putting it. It really is. You can actually focus on the real things in life, and instead of having to focus on how you're going to protect your time and energy that's being wasted away by these insane economic policies.
Yeah, and look, and at the end of the day, I mean, I'd say most families, most people have a personal spreadsheet that they maintain just to make sure they're not sinking, you know. And I think there's still relevance in that, but you know, having to keep track of certain bonds and ETFs and all sorts of things like that, it's like, look, you should just be able to save a little bit every week, and
Exactly, and
that's
no,
it.
there's too many families. I know this because I see it everywhere. It's too many families living paycheck to paycheck, And I don't think you're going to have a spreadsheet trying to track your paycheck to paycheck. I mean, the fact is that you're just trying to tread water and you're just about barely keeping your nose above the water. That's really sad.
Yeah.
And that's something that's happening all over the world. You see all these anecdotes and all these stories all over the people just saying they're doing everything they were told to do. They went to university, they got their jobs, and then they can't even survive because they're going to the grocery store and only coming back with a loaf of bread and some milk after spending $30. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and
That's
it's challenging, and especially from New Zealand, where we're making a lot of this stuff and trying to get a loaf of bread or a bottle of milk in the supermarket is costing you an arm and a leg. It really feels like there's something wrong there, and I think people are feeling it. And of course, the natural knee-jerk reaction is to call for regulation of supermarkets and stuff like that. But
Oh,
no,
that's the thing,
it's
though.
not not the answer.
No, but what we're seeing here in Serbia is we have a big cost of living crisis over here. So, I mean, big. It's not. I mean, official inflation numbers are actually down in single digits, but the real number to look at is CPI. And if you look at CPI, it keeps on going up.
I mean, what does that even mean, though? Like, they change the basket, they mess with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, but look at it. It looks as the way it's accelerated since 2020. It's ridiculous. Then now you're looking also at the M0 and M2 money supply. And now that the recent print I can see at the moment for November. I know we're in January. For November it was at record highs money printing. I mean, it's ridiculous what's going on here. And food inflation over here was about 15, 20%, 30%, 40% at one point. People here are suffering. Thing is, we get a lot of our supermarkets. The supermarkets here get a lot of their produce from outside of Serbia. You're getting a lot of stuff, milk. We have the best milk. We have fantastic milk and produce in Serbia, but we're getting a lot of this milk from Poland because it's apparently cheaper and better or something like that. But no. I think there's a huge disconnect. And I think I would like to work on projects here. My wife and I, we're opening up our foundation. It's the Royal Foundation. Well, we're still kind of deciding on the name. It's the Royal Foundation, the Hereditary Prince Philip and Princess Danica Foundation. And one of the initiatives, I mean, we're going to work on many initiatives, but I guess the core of it is working on maintaining and holding on to cultural heritage. But the other thing is also innovation and having and working with our modern tools to try and help save our local economies. I'm not against globalism. I think globalism is an important part of development all around the world. We need to be trading with our neighbors. But the form that it's taken right now, it's absolute it's damaging. And I
Yeah.
think Serbia has so much produce, so much goods, and so much talent that it's not being used. And that's something that we're going to try and figure out ways and initiatives to try and get that going again. So people actually, because that's part of the reason why a lot of Serbs are leaving the country, because they can find better jobs elsewhere, and there's not much for them here. But if we can stimulate that economy here and make it so people are producing locally and trading locally, foods, the most amazing produces here, then people will stay. People won't move.
What's a circular economy? I mean, what are your thoughts on some of these Bitcoin model communities? We've seen things like Bitcoin Beach or even Lugano, I believe, has that
And
kind of
look, I
Bitcoin.
mean, I think they're great. I mean, I don't think there's such thing as an actual circular economy. I think there's always something that has to come in and out
Yeah.
from the outside. But the idea, I guess, of a lo I think of a localized, I mean, I think it's more going to idea of decentralization as we're talking about politics. The same thing happens with economies as well. I think we have to localize a little bit more. Not going towards protectionism. I'm not not nothing like that. I'm just saying that I think if we can have, like, this is where the European Union went wrong. I think the European Union was a great idea at up until the economic area. Anything after that was a disaster. Open economic area, fantastic. Then having your sovereignty destroyed by having directors being forced on you, not a good idea.
Yeah.
So I'm all for open economic areas, opening borders in that way for growth and stuff. But then I have to make sure you have, but that's only just helps local producers to be more competitive, so they can actually sell not just locally but abroad as well. And in Serbia, I think we have a lot of issues that we are competing with the EU, but the we are getting a lot of our produce with it from the EU, but we don't have the ability to then sell back to the EU. So we should be a net exporter, but we're actually a net importer. And our trade deficits, it's horrible. We're about 30, 40 billion any given moment. That's just reckless, absolutely reckless.
Sorry, is Serbia in the EU in terms of no? Okay, so you're out.
Not the only two former Yugoslavia states, countries that made it into the EU are Slovenia and then Croatia.
I see.
Montenegro is working hard. They just elected a government there, the prime minister. Their party is like pro EU, so they've, I say, cut some deals with the EU to try and meet some goals for them to get full. I mean, they've got candidacy status, I believe, now, but to get integrated. I mean, my opinion is that not a great idea. I think joining the EU now is like joining a sinking ship, but I'm going to get some slack for that as well. But it's true. Serbia is having it more issues because it's wanting to get EU candidate status. There's a lot of people pro, but a lot of people anti, because we want to continue being that sort of neutral country because we have good ties with Russia and China and the BRICS as well. Plus, we have the issue with Kosovo, which actually is that we don't want to recognize Kosovo. And part, I think, one of the prerequisites for only joining the EU is to lose Kosovo, which something a lot of Serbs will not want it to happen. So it's kind of
Yeah,
complicated in Serbia.
I mean, like, I fully appreciate it. I did some deep diving just reading about the history of that area and the former Yugoslavia and that whole thing. And look, it seems like it's very complex, and it's a multi-hour discussion to even get up to
Oh, it
speed
really
about
is.
what it feels like, and what it means. Because what we're trying to find here, though, is principles that we can kind of align on, and I think that's what I see. Similar sized countries, New Zealand's just over 5 million people. It's kind of surrounded by these larger neighbors. There's kind of a lot of water in between, but you've got Australia, you've got China, the United States, and New Zealand in an interesting place where it's not completely allied with any of them. There's sort of certain distances. Even the United States, its warships aren't able to visit New Zealand because of our anti-nuclear policy and things like that. So there's certainly an interesting opportunity, and I think that's what I'm seeing here. These kind of smaller states that are sort of semi, they're still aligned quite strongly, but not completely. And Bitcoin can really be an X factor.
And they can make changes. They can really, yes, they can steer themselves in the right direction better than other larger, more aligned countries.
And so that's where I've got two things I want to share with you, Prince Philip. So look, I think firstly I want to extend an invitation to you to talk more about New Zealand and with your work at Jan3. And look, if there is an opportunity for you to
It would
visit,
be our honor and our pleasure to do that, yes.
thank you. I mean, there's a real solid community here, and it's.
You said you have a political think tanks, but also you said you talked about some because of your system.
So I mean, I've got a friend who works at the New Zealand Initiative, which is a political think tank, looking at policy, and he wrote a great piece on New Zealand infrastructure, and I interviewed him about that. So, and there's a number of others. A lot of my friends work in that sort of area. So there's sort of a lot of these people, and at the end of the day, when you visit, you'll see. But it is a small place. You can bump into them on the street, and you can share an idea, and
That's
it's.
brilliant. That is brilliant. Yes, I didn't realize how as you said, what's the word that you called? How, I mean, localized that is. I mean,
Well,
how
it's very accessible, and
access? That's the word. Sorry, accessible. That is. That's brilliant.
it's very accessible. So I do want to extend an invitation for yourself and Samson and that to come to New Zealand if you get a chance, or maybe we can talk offline about what that means.
We can definitely. What the other question? Sorry, question is the political scene there. You said you had recent elections, and what's the current formation of the government looking like?
So there was a move. So you would have been familiar with Jacinda. So that was the Labour Party.
Yeah, of
So
course.
that was sort of an anomaly in the sense that even though we have an MMP system, they actually were first past the post, one single party. And so they basically had carte blanche to do whatever they wanted.
I know, it was crazy.
I mean, I was there, man. So I mean, I can tell you all about it some other time, but
I would like to hear stories.
The democracy worked out though, because the things have swung back the other way. And so now there's a tri-party system where it's kind of moved across the aisle. And interestingly enough, the party that made that happen, so there's the National Party, which was the major bloc, and then ACT, which is a kind of a centre-right party. Mm-hmm. But then the one that made it happen was the New Zealand First Party, which is Winston Peters, who's mentioned by name in The Sovereign Individual. So he's sort of an interesting character in all of this. And look,
I didn't know that. You know, I haven't actually read, so I'm familiar with the book. I have it at my desk.
It's a long read.
I know. There's a couple of,
I highly recommend it though. And the audiobook's great. But look, I'm not aligned with any of this stuff politically. You know, I think I'm beyond that. I'm a Bitcoiner. But I still see the practicalities of it and the real politic of what that means.
Of course, the only way to make change as well is in the current system is actually by participating in it as well. And this is one thing I had a lot of stick recently for voting.
Yeah.
You know, what's a prince doing voting? Well, number one, we live in a republic. And number two, I was trying to urge people to go use their only sovereignty a choice that they had, and that is to go and vote if you want some sort of change. And it doesn't matter what I vote for, you know, as I said, you know, my ballot could have been completely empty. It's just the fact is, just go out and use the system if you want change. Otherwise,
you're performing the act, and you're
And locally is the best place to start.
That's absolutely right. So look, I do want to extend an invitation for you guys to come to New Zealand. And then secondly, I think what we've talked about today is really, I mean, talking about the transformation of value, the title of this show, kind of what I'm looking at, it's kind of more broadly what I call Bitcoinism, which is sort of the political science of Bitcoin, which I think is an emerging area. And so there's obviously technical stuff and kind of how it all works. But I think we're seeing this really interesting opportunity to engage with transformative conversations that reference the past and understand where we've come from. But we start talking about things like what you're discussing with monarchy, this custodian model. What does that mean for the future? And we can debate it. And I think that debate culture and that freedom of speech is really important, because look, we may be wrong, we may be right, but we need to.
Couldn't agree more. Yes, exactly.
We need to put the ideas out there, you know.
Yeah, because my ideas are my ideas, and it's not going to work everywhere at all. It's probably not going to even work at all. But but we need to debate it. We need to figure it out. That's what's.
What is it? Putting it out.
Yeah,
there.
We need to put it out there. And that's something that's been squashed in recent times, thanks to a lot of things that we can get into, but probably don't have time right now.
No. Thank you. I mean, I think that's like a perfect place to wrap it up. I think we covered a lot of stuff, and I really appreciate you being open and sharing your story and some of your thoughts. Which, you know, as you said, maybe you get a bit of slack, but at the end of the day, we can talk about that more next time.
I know. And I'm just sorry. I'm just saying that because, you know, there's always just going through my Twitter feed and my comments and stuff. Being the prince that's become the Bitcoin prince and stuff, I get a lot of entertaining criticism and stuff. A lot of heat. Some of it very horrible and heated, but some of it quite funny. But some of it's just like, it's just uneducated. It's, people just don't really realize yet. Yeah. But that's great. That's progress, and I'm happy that I'm doing it. I'm happy that I'm putting my reputation, I guess, on the line. But I know I'm doing it. I know I this time I'm pretty certain that Bitcoin is going to do some good things in this world. Yeah, I think we both can agree on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can. And look, at the end of the day, we need to talk about this stuff. So look, I do think that there is an opportunity maybe to dive deeper in the future, maybe a future episode when you've got a chance, we can talk more.
I would love to. Yeah, my pleasure.
But look, I really appreciate your time, Prince Philip, and for broaching these topics. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me, Cody. Been a great conversation with you.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.